This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program this afternoon, navigating times of upheaval in life. Our guest is William Bridges, author of the new book, The Way of Transition, Embracing Life's Most Difficult Moments. William Bridges says people talk a lot about how difficult change is, but it's really transition that's difficult. But transition, he says, puts us on the road to transformation. Thus, we should embrace it. This afternoon, we talk with William Bridges about change and transition and his new book, The Way of Transition. William Bridges began working in the field of transition management in the 1970s. He wrote the best-selling book, Transitions, Making Sense of Life's Changes, some 20 years ago. A consultant and lecturer, he is a former professor of English. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for William Bridges. Join the discussion with the telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. William Bridges' new book, The Way of Transition, is published by Perseus. William Bridges, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Change, transition, two words we're likely to use interchangeably, but for you, two distinct words with distinct meanings. What is transition and how is it different from change?
Well, change is an event. In my case, in the case of the situation that I wrote about in the book, it was the death of my wife. So it's an event. It's a situation. It's something that happens to you, or something, perhaps it's something you initiate yourself, but it is still an event. Transition is the experience that you have as you go through the event. And transition is the way you get through the event, the reorientation that you make in your life in order to make it possible to get through the event. So they're obviously complementary concepts, but change happens and transition is an experience.
This is a very personal book, and you share with readers the story of the profound transition in your life of losing your wife, a transition that began with her diagnosis of cancer, her illness, and her death. And this was a transition so difficult that you found yourself wondering if, after all your work in the field, you really had any idea of what you had been writing about for close to 20 years.
It's kind of peculiar to say, but having written these books on transition, I had a problem that was a little different from the average person's problem in an experience of losing a loved one, and that was I was supposed to know about this stuff, and I was supposed to know how to handle it. Supposed to, I don't know who says you're supposed to, but I thought I was supposed to. And it just was so unexpectedly harder than I imagined that I really did call into question whether I knew enough to even work in the field anymore. It was, however, an experience that really reintroduced me to transition and brought me out with some new ideas about it. And so I came out realizing that if you view something that happens to you as an event, it's like a wall that you have to get over. But if you view it as a transition, it's a path that you can follow through that part of your life and come out the other side. And that's certainly the way it was for me.
Mm. One of the insights I think that you gained in your transition here was that you went from seeing transition as something that happened sometime to something that could be ongoing, something that is an ongoing process.
Yeah, transition is throughout our lives. It operates at every level of our lives, and there's a quote in the book from Kierkegaard that says that every day is a little life, and every morning is a new beginning, and every evening is a little death. And That's true. Transition is a figure in the design of our lives that shows up everywhere. It's like in chaos theory, they talk about fractal figures that are the same at every level of magnification that you look at them. And transition is that way. You look at your whole life, and your whole life starts with you getting expelled from a wonderful environment called the womb, and life is this long in-between stage, and then at the end you move on to some new thing that we don't know. Now, that's at the largest level of magnification, but then you get right down to every little situation where you leave home in the morning and you get to work. And the three phases of transition are always the same. The first phase, ironically, is an ending, letting go, saying goodbye to the past. The second phase is the sort of in-between stage. It isn't the old way, but it isn't the new. And the third phase is the new beginning. And at every level of magnification, whether it's the death of my wife, or whether it is a person changing jobs, or whether it is somebody going on a vacation, there are the three phases of transition. And learning how to manage that process is of invaluable help in life.
Mm. Can you get stuck in one of these phases?
Yeah, you can. I sometimes wondered in my own case if I was stuck in the neutral zone. The neutral zone is a particular place where people get stuck because it's as though you've let go of everything that you were familiar with, and if the future isn't set by circumstances, and sometimes it is, but in my case it wasn't, what was the rest of my life going to be? I was just lost in limbo there, in between the life that I had known very well and a life that I couldn't even imagine. And there were times I went weeks at a time feeling as though I was just completely bogged down and lost and confused. The figure of speech that I think of is the metaphor of Moses going through the wilderness, 40 years in the wilderness, and just this kind of wandering feeling. And I've worked with a lot of people who have had this feeling in the midst of switching jobs, or in the midst of after the kids leave home and they're kind of marking time, trying to figure what else comes next in their lives, or when they've just retired. This neutral zone can be a very scary time, and people who totally bog down in it just kind of stop living at that point and go on to hold.
Yeah.
I think people can also bog down in the ending. That is, the ending is a disengagement process and a sort of mourning process where you're losing the life you had, and you may have a lot of feelings about that. But there are some people who turn that into a whole way of life. Queen Victoria, when she lost Prince Albert, went into mourning for 60 years. And so that ending phase can go on and on and on. Certainly, we all know people who are very bitter about some ending in their lives and who just won't let go of it and have no way of moving on. So, yes, you can bog down in a phase.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to spend 60 years in mourning, nor would I want to spend 40 years in the desert. So
that really is pretty rugged, isn't it?
Yeah. So how do you get unstuck?
Well, the first thing is to make sure that you know, as the transition starts, the first question to ask yourself in transition is, what is it time for me to let go of? And in Queen Victoria's case, I don't know her case that well, but it isn't just Prince Albert. That's true. It usually isn't just an external person or an external job. It's more like the internal connections that we had with that life. And in my case, I found that in losing a partner, I was losing the way that I did a lot of things in my life, the way that I stayed connected with friends, she did a great deal of that. The way that I knew whether my hair was combed in the morning. I mean, really, really trivial things. But the way I knew if my shirt and tie matched. All kinds of things that our relationship had done for me, I was having to let go of. And that, you can say, when you lose something like that, you have to learn a lot of new things, and that's true. But first you have to let go of what it's time to let go of. And in my case, I think I had to let go of a lot of self-images that went with this relationship and develop some new ones. And that can leave you feeling very confused and very bereft for quite a while.
How do we recognize the alarms or whatever is going on that says to us, it's time to let go of something, it's time to end this and begin again?
Well, there are two ways that signals come in on like that. One is a kind of quiet way. You're likely in that case to be in transition before there's any change happen. Now, in my case, there was a change, and so I was in transition. But in many cases, let's say that a person is working at a job that is just less and less and less satisfying. It's just not paying off. It's very mechanical, and you're growing very tired of it. And in that case, the signals are all subjective ones. This isn't the job for me. This is not using my best abilities. This is going nowhere. I'm not respected here at work. These are signals. Now, at what point do you make a decision? That's wholly an individual case, and I think that a lot of people wait too long to make a decision because they're afraid of making the change. But they've really already made a transition. They've already unplugged. They've already let go of that job. And that's what's so hard about the job. They're really already in a kind of neutral zone, but they're trying to keep going and pretend that nothing's happening. Mm. The other kind of signal is when something just falls apart. Let's say that a person has misgivings about work, but really is going to hold on to it and not rock the boat. And then something happens at work that really just messes everything up. Now, it's almost as though we were ready to let go, but we didn't want to do it, and then life came along and yanked the rug out from under us and just really pushed us into it. Sometimes we get external signals like that.
Yeah. In the way of transition, you've included many insights about transition from literature.
And yeah.
That's really interesting. It's really a frequent theme in literature, isn't it?
It is. As a matter of fact, when I think back to the way I was taught to look at literature, it often talked about development and denouement, where a situation revealed itself, or a character developed, or a character had a breakthrough. Now, all those things involve transition some way or other. When I taught literature, I used to say that these things involve change. And that's true, and that's true as far as it goes. But at that time, I didn't personally understand the difference between change and transition. And so I just thought that it involved change, and the transition, I don't know what I thought transition was at that time. It has been very useful to me, though, to learn the difference between the two and to see that transition is a much more inward process in my life. It's often triggered off by change, and in literature, it's often changes lead to transitions. But when Hamlet is coming to accept the fact that his mother has married his uncle and that the uncle killed the father and all of these things, Hamlet is a guy in transition. He's going from being an ordinary, accepting son and nephew to being somebody who is just overwhelmed by what has happened and who feels that he has to act finally.
Mm. On tomorrow's program, we're going to talk with a novelist by the name of John Banville, who's written a book called Eclipse. And at the heart of this book is an actor in middle age whose career comes to a screeching halt when on stage he goes absolutely blank. And so what he does is he goes to live in the house where he was a boy, and his wife helps him move back into the old place. But she also tells him, you know, when he says it'll be good to be here and to pull myself together, she tells him, you know, you never left here.
Well, you know, there's a moment of transition for you.
There's
he imagined that his life was going down one path. He imagined that he was just a successful middle-aged actor. And that's a good example of what I mean when life comes in and tells you something. His going blank on stage is a clear signal of something. And it's a signal that something is over, that he has to pay attention to it. And it's a kind of clinical signal, but and most of us don't get those. But it's not that unusual, really, to have that sort of a signal, a sudden depression, a sudden anxiety attack, a sudden bout of forgetfulness, where we suddenly realize that something that we've been counting on just isn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm. And also that his wife says, you never left here.
It's, now, I, of course, haven't read the book.
Yeah.
But in your reading of the book, is she saying that really, as he's still the boy he was?
Yeah.
That the rest of his life just has been kind of unreal, and he's still that kid?
Yeah.
Well, that's something where people... People do freeze at points in their lives, and although they may externally look as though they're progressing on, they're still back there. Sometimes it's traumatic. They're back there because of a traumatic experience, the loss of a parent or something like that. But sometimes they're back there because they just never developed past that point.
Yeah. There's also a ghosts in the story, so to speak, and these are his ghosts, really. But there's also a place where he tells his wife on the telephone one evening, she's in their home in London or wherever, and he's in his boyhood home, and he tells her, this place is haunted. And she says, well, you know, you're your own ghost. So I think that he is also, he's not dealt with the ghosts of his life.
One of the things that the way of transition is pretty clearly about is trying to keep current on the relationship to change in your life. A lot of people don't, and as a result, they go through situations which really call on them to let go of the way they've been, but they don't do that. They just make external changes. Sometimes a person will actually do such a large thing as getting a divorce, but not really make any internal shifts. That, and so the person is still the same person that got into the difficulty in that marriage. And if the person starts another marriage at that point, the chances are very good that the new marriage will have the same problems that the old marriage did. And in that sense, I've come to see that people often make changes, in that case, switching to a new marital partner, they often make changes so that they won't have to make transitions. That is, so that they won't have to let go of who they were or who they thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't have that awful time in the neutral zone when it feels like your life has stopped and the rest of the world keeps going, but you're stuck. And then they won't have to take those risky steps necessary to make a new beginning. And I think it's really transition, not change, that people are scared of. And people who allow that fear to stop them from making transitions get way behind in their own development. they may be living a successful external life, moving from job to job and from one circle of friends to another, but inwardly they're not developing at all. And it's a kind of Portrait of Dorian Gray situation, where you remember in Oscar Wilde's story, his portrait aged while he stayed young and attractive. The person doesn't really develop. Somewhere inwardly, there's a person who's growing older there, but it isn't there to see.
In a chapter titled Letting Go of My Life, you write, we don't let go of anything important until we've exhausted all the possible ways that we might keep holding on to it.
Yeah, I think we associate who we are with the circumstances of our lives. And so we, rather than let go of something that has been a large part of who we think we are, and I really have to say who we think we are, because at any given time, that's not necessarily accurate as to who we are. But rather than let go of something that is part of who we think we are, we hold on to it. And this is true of people who hold on to relationships that aren't good for them, who hold on to behaviors that aren't good for them, who hold on to work that isn't good for them. And in all of those cases, an objective observer would say you'd be better off really without that thing. But we just can't imagine letting go of it.
Are there points in life when we're less open and points where we're more open to transition?
Yes. Certainly subjective points, very much so. I think that I have just been through, personally, one of those points in my life, because so much of my identity and my sense of meaning in my life was tied up in this marital relationship, that as that broke apart and as I slowly disengaged myself from all the pieces that had for me, I found myself very much more open to lots of other changes. Now, I don't think you can say that happens because I was a certain age. It happened because of a situation. And so there are a few ages when people, I think, are particularly open to new things. Adolescence would be one of them. Certainly adolescents are at a period where they're trying a lot of new identities. The so-called midlife period is another one where people question the commitments that they've made and question if they're really the same person who chose the career that they're in. So midlife is probably another time. But generally speaking, I think that it's the transition periods in our lives, whenever they occur, that are times when we're really open to and exposed to a lot of new things. Mm.
William Bridges is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his new book, The Way of Transition, Embracing Life's Most Difficult Moments. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. In Champaign-Urbana, the telephone number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free. The toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi, this is Jan Jefferson, and I want to say I'm really, really grateful for this program about transition and change. I want to ask one important question of maybe it's William Bridges, Dr. Bridges, whoever.
Bill.
The question is, do you think this is a solitary experience? Do you think, in other words, you have to experience it alone, by yourself, or can you incorporate others? Do you have to rely upon other people? And then I'll listen to your answer.
Okay, Jan. I think it other people are very important, and that there's a danger in an experience like this that you just get so preoccupied with what's happening to you that you shut yourself off from other people. Certainly in my case, I found that in a lot of my previous life, it had been my wife who had made the contacts with our friends and who kept a lot of friendships going in our lives. And so I had a bit of a crisis myself when she wasn't there anymore to do that. And it was very, very important for me to pick up that task and start doing that myself. And that was a big new beginning for me and a very important one. But at the same time that I would say that other people are very important and it's important to keep contact with them, it's also true that there's one level in which you are absolutely alone. Death itself is a very alone experience, not that other people can't be around, and not that other people can't be supportive, but it is something that you go through individually. Mm-hmm. The dying person goes through it individually, and in many ways, the bereaved person, bereavement is an individual experience. Mm-hmm. Now, it's an individual experience that you can share with others, but I think it would be misleading to say that this is something that other people can ever know from the inside. You're the only one who really knows it from the inside. And that's one reason why you may have to take special steps to share it and communicate it to others. It happened that I was in therapy at the time that my wife was dying. She had breast cancer, and so this was a 2-year period. And I was in therapy during this time, and that was immensely useful to me because it gave me somebody that I really could talk with about all the difficulties I was having with the situation.
I'm really, really grateful for your response because when we're born alone, and when we die alone. My background is in hospice. And last night we had a speaker who lost a twin through a traffic accident. And she has one word which I think probably now is very valuable to her. I am eternal, I am infinite, blah, blah. But, you know, I felt that way too. I have MS, it is my diagnosis. But the point is, you may think those thoughts, but how long do you think them? This is like a yo-yo. Sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that issue?
Oh, it is like a yo-yo. It's as you move through an experience of transition. At first, you're just overwhelmed with the ending. And when I say ending, I don't just mean the death of somebody. I mean that any transition starts with letting go of the life you had. So, by definition, it starts with an ending. And at first, you're overwhelmed with that, and then you begin to come through that just a tiny bit, and you begin to see little glimmers, at first just a few minutes at a time, of another way that you could feel. You don't quite feel that way yet, but you could feel another way. And it is just a tremendous roller coaster ride. Just the day that you think you're really getting things together, or just the day that you have a really nice conversation with somebody and you feel as though maybe you're coming out of the tunnel at last, something else comes up and you're right back in the darkness. So it's a terrible roller coaster ride.
I appreciate so much your honesty because I experienced this also, both now as personally, but anyway, you give me hope, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. One of the things that I tried to do in writing the book is to really write honestly. I have read a lot and heard a lot of people talk who are very, very hopeful, but in my experience, the hope, while it's a pretty good company, it's nice, you feel better while you're hopeful, it doesn't necessarily point you in a better direction. And I found myself longing, and that's not too strong a word, longing for records, either written or in conversation, of somebody who'd talk honestly to me about what it had really been like. So that's what I tried to do in the book. I ended up writing some things about my marriage, for instance, that I think some of my friends were worried that I had written, because they felt that they were too personal, or they were too they should have been more upbeat, and but that just didn't work for me.
Writing this book, how did it feel, the act of writing it?
Well, that was something that was very interesting. I thought at the time that I was starting the book that I was just trying to write what the experience had been like just for my own reasons. And then as I started realizing that it had given me a different view of transition, I started throwing in some more stuff about the transition process. And then as I went more deeply into what my life had been up till that time and sort of the context for this particular transition, I found myself going back to issues in the past or events in the past and seeing them in a wholly new light. And that's one of the things that really a profound transition does for you. It puts everything that you've been through in a different light. And most people don't sit down and write a book at that time, and I'm almost a little apologetic for having done it. But if you happen to be writing a book at that time, you find yourself going back over what you thought was familiar ground, and suddenly it isn't familiar anymore. And you find yourself seeing things about your past that you didn't know. And I came out of the experience thinking that it's not only our futures that are there for us to shape, it's our pasts that are there for us to shape. And that was something that was a tremendous learning to me in the process of writing the book.
I want to share something from the book, if I might, a paragraph
here.
You write, "It is not the fact of being in transition that most people mind, but rather that they cannot place their experience of being in transition within any larger, meaningful context. Without such a context, the endings are for no reason, the beginnings open the door to nowhere, and the neutral zones extend end to end across an empty landscape." So then you go on to write about some exercises that we might do, or some ways we might think about this, giving ourselves some context. And maybe you would talk with us about one or more of these, the chapter exercise, the path you have followed, the river named you.
What I there isn't very much in the book that is a to-do list, because it so many of those things just left me cold when I read them in other books. But one of the things that I do know is that when you're in transition, it's really important to have a bigger picture in some way. It's one thing to know that you're at a certain place on the map, but where is that in relation to the rest of the map? That question really kind of haunted me. Where is my life going? Where did it come from? And so I found myself wanting to place this particular experience, which happened in my 60s, in a larger context. And the three exercises you mention are ones that I suggest in the book as ways of doing it. One is to imagine, actually, if you had the time to write your autobiography, that would be great, and that would place it in context. But since most people don't have that kind of time or won't take that kind of time, a much simpler way to do it is to say, if you were writing your autobiography, what would the titles of the chapters be? And in that case, you sit down with a piece of paper and 10 minutes and write down chapter titles of every chapter in your imaginary autobiography. And they should be chapter titles that are evocative, that are not just, Chicago 1974 to 1977. Those are dull. But hitting the big time, or bottoming out, or any title that captures the feeling of that period in your life. Now, when you've written those chapter titles, then you make sure that the current transition has a chapter title too. And as you look at your whole life then as a kind of unfolding path, very often you see some things about this transition that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. Another way is to do it visually and draw it as a river or as a path that you follow. Those are two different ways. And in that case, you aren't so verbal. You're more describing in the twists and turns and switchbacks what it was like to go through different periods of your life. Has one place been a swamp, and another place been a long, hard climb, and still another place a walk through a very crowded city, and another place a country lane? So those are ways of looking at your life and placing the particular transition in a larger context.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a very interesting conversation. So far, though, it has been mostly about individuals coping with change and going through the transitions in life. I have started working with congregations who are going through transitions. And I was wondering if you have any insights into how groups of people might be helped to work through the transitions in their community life.
Well, you bring up a great point. And I think that the reason that I'm talking so individually is that my experience was so individual. But until quite recently, almost all my work was with groups, was with not individuals. And so I do have a number of ideas about what your situation suggests. In any change situation, and let's imagine that you're talking about somebody who, you're talking about a church or a temple that has just lost its pastor, its minister.
Yes.
And that's a change. The departure of a minister is a change. Now, the whole congregation, however, and even some people outside the congregation, are in transition because of it. And the three phases of transition are worth looking at. One is there's an ending, and the questions there are, what have they lost? And not just the minister, but has a whole chapter of their collective life closed out? Have they lost some of the dreams that carried them this far? And obviously, you'd have to get down to the specific situation, which I don't know. And so let me just leave it at that. The second question would be, in between the old and the new, what can you do to help this whole group get through the wilderness, to use the Moses figure of speech? And some groups, the Presbyterian Church in this country, for instance, use interim ministers.
Oh, that's what I am.
That's what you are.
Yes,
okay.
I'm a Presbyterian interim minister, yes.
Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful way to help a group, because it says this in-between stage is its own special time and has its own special needs. And then the third phase is the new the new beginning, and that new beginning may mean that the interim person leaves and still another person comes, or it may be some shift in the role of the interim person. There's the book Managing Transition, which is the book that I wrote back around 1990 on organizational transition. And that's a book that's been quite widely used both in corporations and churches in talking about how to get people through transition.
Well, thank you. I will definitely look up your book. It did strike me, as you had been talking earlier, that a lot of the dynamics that you were speaking of concerning individuals are also very similar to what happens with the group. It's not that different.
That's right. Whole groups go into mourning.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes.
Just the way an individual does.
Yes.
And whole groups wander in the wilderness just the way an individual does.
Yes.
So well, I think you're right.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Before we go, I thought, before we wrap things up here, or to wrap things up, I thought maybe I would ask you, I am asking you, to talk about the benefits, or what you call the functions of transitions.
Well, transition, when I started writing about it back in the late 70s, I thought transition was just the psychological process which got you from the old place to the new place. And it still has that function, and I call that the reorientation function, to sort of turn you around and get you plugged in a new way. But in more recently, and in this particular, this situation in my life, I've recognized that there are other functions that are very important. One is a developmental function. We go through our life pretty much the same person for long periods of time. But obviously, as we get older and as life has different demands on us, we really should be inwardly changing all the time to be ready for the future. And we aren't. And so transition comes along and gives us a belt. It jogs us. And the letting go we do is letting go of a slightly outlived way of functioning. And the new beginning we make is the beginning of a more adequate way of plugging into life. So that's developmental. There's also a renewal function where that letting go or the ending process and the neutral zone, a fallow time almost like winter and a new beginning almost like spring, is a death and rebirth process which brings new energy into our lives. And at the end of my book, I write about my own new beginning, which involved getting remarried, and finding how much energy came into my life in that way. So renewal is very much part of transition. If we didn't have transition, we probably would just slowly run out of gas in our lives. Transition brings new energy, new focus, new purpose, new meaning into our lives.
Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for letting me do it, Celeste.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay.
And the best to you and your wife.
Thank you very much.
William Bridges has been our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His new book is The Way of Transition, Embracing Life's Most Difficult Moments.